Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
On this episode of the Indie Opera Podcast, we are joined by Huang Ro, composer of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, and we talk about his musical influences and growing up in China. Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
And this is Noah.
This is Walker.
And we are joined today with Huang Ro, who is the composer of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, which is going to be performed in Santa Fe this summer, July 26th through August 14th. And we're really, really glad to have you on the program. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Often what we like to do before we get into any deep subjects, which I'm sure we'll get into, is talk about what we've seen, if we've seen anything since our last show. Have you seen anything lately, Huang?
You mean as opera-wise?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, I was at Spoleto, so I saw El Nino, and also Facing Goya. I saw several operas there.
Facing Goya is Michael Nyman?
Yes.
That's right, yeah.
But what are mortal hearts whose spirits cannot be?
Such is
Well, to me, it's definitely an opera that is not a narrative opera. It's more about, an issue. Let's put it that way.
There we go again. Listen, we've been our last two shows. We've been talking about how people don't know how to handle story very well. Mm. So another opera that's non-narrative. Okay, go on. What was the general thought?
Well, to me, I do feel the production, the director, the production does make the opera, lifted the opera up, in my opinion. It's definitely something I need to see it one more time to really understand. I will just leave it as that.
Okay.
I know. Did you know much of Michael Nyman's music before you saw it, or do you like his music?
I saw his film music. This is my first time to see a stage work. So I should not say I'm expert at it, and so that's why I do think it would need second viewing. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Do you mean the Peter Greenaway films, those collaborations?
Yes. Also, the famous one, the piano.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So Yeah, so in that sense, I do know him more from the, you know, the film world, let's say,
right,
that.
Right.
So not the concert or theater or opera world. Yeah.
Mm. I was also down there as well.
Oh.
but I didn't
Did
see.
Did you see?
No, I saw nothing because I was at a wedding.
That's that's important.
Yeah.
Of course.
What did you think of El Nino?
El Nino, well, you know, to me, actually, the production and the music does work well together. Mm-hmm. And I think the director did a good job at trying to, you know, to make it clear. Because if you hear different people singing, it's not only one person being the narrator. So there are different people playing the role of the narrator, and and I do think the stage does make it more, you know, more clear, and also it's quite enjoyable, I should say.
Mm.
Once again, a non-narrative piece, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't really, it sort of tells a story like an oratorio tells a story, right?
Mm-hmm. It's more an oratorio than an opera, I should say.
Mm,
So now I'd like to throw in the other thing I saw. I saw Gloria, a Pigtail.
Oh, I just saw that today.
Oh, you did? What'd you think?
Yeah. I enjoyed it. It was entertaining. The music, I just had a few issues with the music.
Really?
I mean, I thought it was fantastic music. But sometimes I think it just stayed on one level for me for a long time. It needed more dramatic changes, I thought.
Work is this? I don't know anything about this.
All right, it's the composer's H.K. Gruber, who's who has done a lot of film, actually. I think he's from Vienna. The best way to describe the music would be that it's sort of like a soldier's tale, the Stravinsky soldier's tale, in that there are a lot of pieces where it's basically two chords that it keeps going back and forth between the two chords, just like it does in the soldier's tale. So you bum, bum, bum.
But in soldier's tale, there's a reason. It's like the walking, right? You have this, creates this ostinato.
Yes, right. And it sort of created this playful background in which the story is told. The one thing about the piece is that the harmonic rhythm, by which I mean the chord, always changed on the beat like that. It was it went on for almost.
Were there any subdivisions? Was it like minimalist?
Oh, tons,
was there...
tons. It was
okay.
I mean, the violin writing was really like a soldier's tale. Like if I think he was actually quoting it because stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So really kind of like bright, diatonic, and spiky kind of rhythms, eighth note rhythms, oscillating rhythms, that kind of thing. Okay.
And the other addition to the sound world would have been, there's a lot more brass and there's actually saxophone. So it's like, it's got trumpet, trombone, full sax. It was,
you know, I have this impression for absolutely no reason, but that kind of music always reminds me of Saturday mornings. I don't know why. There's something cartoony and really sunny about that, like Stravinsky's, that music of that, that's like that. You know, like the Symphony in C, maybe, like the really bouncy diatonic stuff.
It's true. It does. Yeah.
Well, and it's perfect for this piece. I mean, the piece really does have that feel. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And also, I think that is the Gruber style. You know, he's always playful and not totally serious, and he often is the narrator himself and being part of the piece. But I don't think he was there today, right?
No, he was there. He was there when I saw it.
Oh, great. Okay.
He came.
I don't think he was there today. Yeah.
The conductor was, of course, Alan Gilbert, who's the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, and this was part of their, I guess they're calling it a biennial every 2 years.
Right.
This is the first year they're doing it, but every 2 years they're going to do a new music, even though this technically isn't new, but a new music festival. And it was directed by Doug Fitch, the guy who directed the Dwarf that I worked on. And Doug, amazing job with the production here. Very playful. You saw a lot of large puppet heads. The cows, there were these two huge cows that were drawn sort of flat with these heads that oscillated. It was just adorable.
Yeah, it was.
So, and the person I went with sat there with the biggest smile on his face through the whole thing. So you know that it was working for us.
That's a good sign. Yes.
Great.
So that's the other, that's the thing I saw.
Wonderful.
Anyone else see anything?
I haven't seen any opera, but I did see the Yale Schola Cantorum sing Haydn's Harmony Messa, which is like one of the last works that he did for Esterházy. So not opera, but related by singing. That's how I can string it in there. But it was really good. I don't know. I'm so removed from that kind of stuff. It's not that often that I go out and see a mass, you know, performed, and it was really great. So yeah,
great.
But no opera.
Once again, a non-narrative.
Yeah, non-narrative. This one, but it didn't bother me. Also, you know, I'm the one that isn't as bothered by non-narrative works as you are, Peter. I think you want things to be a little more Sherlock Holmes than.
Listen, it's not that I'm against non-narrative pieces. I love non-narrative pieces. The problem is everything is non-narrative.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. Well.
It just seems that we have this dearth of people don't know how to tell a story. So let's actually switch then to Dr. Sun Yat-sen because we have a story.
Indeed.
In this case, yes. There's a story.
And this is one, the gentleman.
Many stories, not just the story of the opera, but then the story of the production of the opera is another story too, right? So
yes,
a couple stories.
Actually, I want to get to a story that I don't quite understand. And I sort of been reading around trying to find out more about your biography, Huang, because you were born in China. How old were you when you left? What was going on in China while you were there?
Well, I was born in 76, so that was the end of the Cultural Revolution. I grew up in the 80s, basically, 80s and early 90s, and I came to U.S. to study when I was 18, so I left China in the mid-90s.
So what were you doing musically before coming to the United States?
Well, in my case, my father actually is a composer also. Mm-hmm. So I kind of grew up in a musical family. My mom, although is a doctor, but she loves to sing and more outgoing musically than my dad is. My dad is more observed. And so I played the piano when I was little. And so there was the story of me getting very nervous playing on stage. You know, I used to play Bach on stage, and I would make mistakes, and then I start improvising. I remember my teacher always told me, you know, if you cannot remember anything and make a mistake, number one, do not stop, and number two, do not repeat from the beginning and replay it again.
Okay.
So somehow just skip it or do something and continue. So never stop. So I think that is my earliest lesson of professionalism. So I improvised in the style of Bach, and surprisingly, a lot of audiences did not know about that.
That's a great story.
So then my teacher finally set my father down, say, you know what, I think your son is better to be a composer than a pianist. So here I was, and my father sent me to Shanghai to study music in the Conservatory of Music. When I was 12, so I left my family to Shanghai when I was 12. My family lived in Guangzhou, so that's a city in the south, and Shanghai is in, you know, middle.
So,
Yeah.
So your training, it was, did you focus on the Western music tradition, or where did the Chinese folk or classical tradition influence you?
Well, basically from my father, although he didn't really teach me as a teacher, but I grew up in the household of both Western and Eastern music, and my father also writes for both instruments and often plays, in those days, it's like cassette tapes and records, you know, those old days. And when I went to Shanghai, mainly I received a Western classical music training. Although I also have friends who play Chinese instruments, so I was always very interested in those instruments and also music written for them. And
Did you play a Chinese traditional instrument?
I mean, I kind of mess around with the guzheng, but I'm not really, you know, playing it well. Let's put it that way.
What does the guzheng look like for our listeners, or sound like, maybe?
Right, guzheng is kind of like a koto, you know, in it's like a zitar, and
on your lap.
In the Chinese version is they have stands, but the original version is a very ancient instrument called guqing. Guqing is like a, you know, could be various strings, like seven strings, for example. And guzheng is larger, so the sound are louder. It's a modern version of guqing. So, but by modern, that's still several hundred years old already.
Right. It's like modern piano. It's played with a pick, or it's played with fingers, or?
You actually play with fingers, and with guzheng, you actually play with fake fingernails.
And
guqing, you just play with fingers. So that makes it sound softer, but more intimate. So guqing actually is a form of
chamber music.
Yeah, it's even more like you play for yourself, like you
don't
play for anyone else. In the ancient time, people burn an incense, right? So they count the time by how fast or how slow the incense burns, and so they play, and maybe they will recite a poetry or sing along with it. So it come in different form musically. It's absolutely one of my favorite instruments. And the story goes is when I was in the practice room in Shanghai Conservatory of Music in a pre-college division, so next door to me, someone is playing a Paganini, you know, a violin piece. And someone also playing the exactly same piece, but on a Chinese erhu. It's a Chinese instrument.
And, that's the violin one.
In a different key. Yeah, that's the equivalent to violin.
Right,
so
right.
To me, it just sounds so bizarre. You have the same piece in different key played by two very totally different instruments. So I went to...
it was like a global Charles Ives.
South Ice version in China, and then I went to my friend who played the erhu, and I asked him, you know, about the piece, and he was telling me, you know, because they do not have too many contemporary Chinese repertoires written for the instruments, so their teachers or other people arrange the Western repertoire to be played on Chinese instrument. So I guess from that point on, I just told myself, you know, if I can, in the future, I do want to write more music involving Chinese instruments, either as part of the ensemble or orchestra or as solo instruments, and so that this beautiful art form would not just die.
So now, did they have an opera department in the school?
in the college division, there is an opera department. So I was in the pre-college division from 12 to 18. Although it's a boarding school, basically. You learn music, you learn academic work, everything in the school. We do not have a vocal department, but any other instruments, you name it, you know, you have Western instruments, also you have Chinese instruments.
I'm so curious. So
yeah, it's quite interesting combination. Yeah.
So how, historically, what was their, like, 20th century orientation? Like, did they have a bias towards certain types of, certain composers in the 20th century? Were there any, was Stravinsky a thing that they even talked about? Or was that I'm kind of curious.
Well, this is 76, so.
Yeah, well.
Well, what is, at least from my memory, Kams, is, basically the reality is China started opening up its gate to the Western world after the Cultural Revolution. So 80s is absolutely the time where new things come and people often has, you know, conflicting thoughts about debating, you know, different kinds of debates. Is this good? Is this bad? And until there was a leader called Deng Xiaoping, you know, the chairman Deng Xiaoping, who succeeded Mao. And he said, you know, it's like opening up the window. You have fresh air, and then you also have different kind of
debris.
That's right, like dirt and insects.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
So you need to accept the fact and embrace it to face this reality.
What was it like to have that after the Cultural Revolution, where people, so you're saying that people were not of one opinion, right? You're saying there were people who were scared of culture, there were people who were probably really excited about culture. Is that what you're saying? It was just kind of something that was so new.
Well, I think in the larger picture, there was, of course, this bigger debate of what is beauty. So for some people, the beauty is unity. Everyone is wearing the same color of shirt, riding the same bicycle. You know, you actually, if you look at the old photos in the early 80s of China or late 70s, or even during the Cultural Revolution, you see people wearing same clothes and riding on the same bicycle. There are not much cars around. So in a way, it's like a massive unity.
And
so
it doesn't matter what the color is or what the bicycle is. It's just the fact that it's unity. Type.
You know, there's no imported bicycle. It's one brand and this and that. And of course, there's another debate is color is beauty. You know, to some people wearing different colors. I remember, blue jean was a big thing in the 80s. And I personally own different colors from blue, black, you know, purple, you know. And also, even when I was in Shanghai, you know, I went in 89. In those days, we use you can't just buy things if you have money. You have to have something we call the tickets. So you need tickets to buy soap. You need tickets to buy meat or buy rice, buy vegetables. So everything is we call that planned market. So if your household has more people, then you get more tickets. If your household has less people, you get less tickets. So I mean, one good thing out of that is you don't really see overweight people, you know. It's just so we just barely get enough, and but then that is a different kind of a circumstance.
Yeah.
Curious about pop music. What was it like? Was there pop music? Could you buy tapes underground, or could you?
Very good question. Actually, we do have pop music. So the pop music came in the 80s, you know, mid to late 80s. So you have pop music from Hong Kong, which is very big, especially in southern China, where I'm from. Also from Taiwan, also. So the Hong Kong pop music is in Cantonese.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Taiwan pop music is in Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
So you will see people who don't speak Cantonese, but they're learning the pop songs in Cantonese. You also have, I think in the early 90s or late 80s, early 90s, definitely you have Western pop music also coming in, and a lot of them are through I won't say underground channel, but it's more like pirates, pirate CDs or cassette tapes.
Who were you? Who were the Western?
So for me, for example, you know, Gun and Roses, Michael Jackson, you know, so the pop culture, right? So so you're talking about soft rock, and then you have heavy metal, you know, all those kind of things. But in China, it's very interesting. In northern culture, in northern China, they are very into rock and roll music.
Uh-huh.
There was a trend in northern China, Beijing or west of Beijing, we call Chinese folk rock. So basically, Chinese singers they were influenced by rock music or rock and roll, and then they combined with folk music. So you hear this tune is quite interesting mix of both, and I personally love it. And I also sing Chinese folk rock as well that movement.
Who were like the top five acts would you say, or like the top three? Or just like bands, or like were there ones that just got so famous or everybody knows X or Y?
Well, we often call the godfather, his name is Cui Jian, you know. I actually met him once in China. So he is very he has several very, very famous CDs, and is one of the pioneer to embrace rock music. Cool. Band wise, you have there's a band called Hei Bao, how to translate in English, like a black liver or something, and then you have another band called
Black Liver, Black Panther.
Yeah, Black Panther, exactly.
Oh, cool.
Panther.
Okay, okay.
Oh, cool. Wow.
And then you have another group called Tang Dynasty.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
They're a different band. And Tang Dynasty went into trouble and disbanded, I believe, was because of drug problem, you know? Yeah. So, which in China was illegal.
That's a familiar story.
That's familiar with Western bands.
They have to get high, so that they create arts are more, you know, otherworldly. You know? So in that sense, so those are the early famous bands.
And were you familiar with traditional Chinese opera? Had you seen any when you were growing up?
Yes, I do. I was born in Hainan Island, and my grandparents and a lot of relatives lived there. So I visited them several times a year, and I still remember my grandma, who loves the Hainanese opera. So she would take me to see opera, you know, every week or something.
Oh, wow.
So there's a touring troupe came to different village, and they will perform in the outdoor theater.
And this is Western opera, or this is Chinese opera?
Chinese opera.
Right, right,
well,
right.
The thing is, when we talk about Chinese opera, there's so many kinds. So it's not just Peking opera, which is very famous now, either thanks to films or thanks to people who went to Beijing and see it. But we have, for example, Kun opera, Kunqu, that's one of the oldest Chinese operatic form. And that is from Shanghai region, Shanghai region, Jiangsu region.
Kunqu?
Yeah, Kunqu. Have you seen Kunqu, a Pinya Pavilion, like in the night?
Yes,
yeah,
So that is Kun opera, you know.
Oh,
so,
that's fantastic. Yeah.
It's very beautiful art form. Kunqu means Kun song or Kun, how should I say, like music. So it's not really an opera, but later on it developed into Kunqu. So Ju means opera. So it started just with almost like in a Italian world, you have these madrigals, you know, you have different things. It's just for singing. It's not meant to be staged. And later on, you do divide it up as a recitative and aria, then it enable story to be developed and become an opera. So in Chinese opera, we also have recitative and aria, you know, have people speaking, but because the way they speak, almost like singing as well. So it's very interesting.
Is there a change? Is there a change in orchestration that's comparable? Like, are there instruments that go with recitative and instruments that go with more aria song-like things?
Yeah. So when aria song-like, the instrument mostly playing exactly the same as the voice.
Ah, okay.
So it's more
unison.
It's less polyphony, right?
Uh-huh.
So when there's a more recitative moment, it's less instruments, just a few, or even just percussion instruments. Now, one thing quite unique in Chinese opera is there's no conductor. So the conductor is the percussionist who actually controls the beat. Now, the percussion, so the orchestra, the band actually is not off stage or in the pit. There's no such a thing called pit, right? So they are performed on the side of the stage, so they could still see what's going on the stage, but the audience actually do not see the musicians.
Have you written an opera in that style, or would you like to?
Well, I study them and I know a great deal about them, but I have not written any opera in exactly that style. Because I could, but for me it's better to use my strength and time and talent to really do something new in that sense.
I mean, you could probably write an opera in Puccini style, but would you want to?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Again, the ancient people did it much, much better. And what is the language today of our, you know, what do we speak today? So that's what I'm interested with. I could be inspired, and I do actually inspire by the Chinese operatic form. For example, in Dr. Sun Yat-sen, I do also integrates both Eastern and Western operatic form and singing as well. So, but that doesn't mean I will write an opera as traditional as Chinese opera.
Chelsea Opera presents the American classic, The Tender Land by Aaron Copland. June 13th and 14th at St. Peter's Church in Chelsea, New York City. For more information, go to chelseaopera.org.
Yeah.
Right. So you want this work, the Sun Yat-sen, the opera, you want it to be, do you want it to be something that transcends Western or folk opera? Do you want it to be just a new work, or do you want it to be a Western opera per se?
Well, depends on how you see it. I mean, to me, the opera, Dr. Sun Yat-sen is written in Chinese, in Mandarin, and there's also a section of it is in Cantonese. Mm-hmm. So the language, now, we are all opera people here. When you listen to French opera and German opera, Italian or English opera, I mean, the music is different. And a lot of them because of the language, you know, the recitative is different, the way singing is different. So in Chinese, it's the same. So when I write for Chinese, this language, it will affect how I approach to vocals writing and also music itself.
Okay, now let's just get clear with Dr. Sun Yat-sen. So you have two versions. You have one that was written for Western Orchestra that that Noah and I heard at Vox like four years ago. And then now
2011,
The new are you doing the version that you're doing in Santa Fe, is that the Western, or are you doing more bringing the Chinese instruments?
Well, actually, as now I have three versions.
Oh, really?
So, you know, to me, it's good because it creates more variety. And I'm the kind of people, I love variety than unity, right? So the one version is just purely Western orchestra, orchestra instruments. There's no Chinese instrument at all. And the second version, a different version, is only Chinese instruments. So that was premiere in Hong Kong with the Hong Kong Chinese Orchestra. And so in that version, there's no Western instrument at all. So entire pit of 60 Chinese instruments. Right. So when Santa Fe approached me to do the American premiere of the opera, and it's a new production, also they want to commission a new version, which is based on the Western orchestra version. But plus, I have nine Chinese instruments played by three Chinese musicians. Wow. So it is the what I call
not the at the same version. Time.
What do you mean? Like,
no, like they're playing? No, not playing.
Oh, yeah. Not at the okay, same time. Sorry. But you know the thing about the that's another thing about Chinese musician is I believe it's same as a Western musician in the old days. Mm. One person could play multiple instruments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was a great tradition, and I wish we could still do that nowadays. A trumpeter suddenly pick up a violin to play. So in that case, these three musicians can manage to play nine different instruments.
Now let's talk a little bit about the Chinese version. I know you did it in Hong Kong, and then there was a plan to move it to Beijing, and then the plan was scrapped at the last moment, and. What's the story behind that?
Well, the original premiere should be in Beijing with the Western instrument version. Now, you and Noah heard the Vox presentation, right. So that is the Western version. Ah. So only Western instruments. So that's supposed to happen before the Hong Kong world premiere of the Chinese version, right? Uh-huh. They decided to cancel it because now the exact reason, at least from what I learned, is the music is not appropriate to the subject. Like, with Dr. Sonia Sen, the theater leader told me, you know, the assumption would be more. How do you say glorifying?
It was a form of censorship, really. Would you say?
Well, I mean, I my opera got canceled, so no matter what you call that, it did not happen. And in that sense, it's very how should I say? I think this mentality is still kind of like a Soviet Union kind of mentality, you know. So so it was very sad and. So we moved to Hong Kong, so our Hong Kong production was able to take place.
To me, if in the early 21st century, if you're writing an opera that a government is preventing the first performance of, it seems to me like you're doing something very right with your time, you know?
Well, yes. Well, to me, I think I keep my I keep the music, I keep the integrity. So I did not, you know, I wasn't changing it or didn't change it for any reason. To me, I feel I'm honest to myself and to my creation. So that is something I feel happy and also confident about. Right. And no matter what, I mean, this is a very sad and experience to me. But the great thing I learned out of this, you know, I still remember the feeling when I came back to New York. I took on a small piano solo piece to write, you know. So that moment, I just want to write every day, you know. I really enjoy my time composing every day. And since that on, I do compose every day, no matter how hard or how busy I am, because this is the ability no one could take away from me.
Right.
Yeah.
So now
it's so beautiful.
The subject matter, one of the things that may have offended them is that it seems that you're taking a more personal first person as opposed to a historical look at the man. You're trying to expose sort of his inside as a human being. In it. Now, how did you find the content to do that? Like, where did the librettist, where did Candace, where did she actually do her research to find out about his personal life?
Well, basically, when we decided to write this opera, we both agreed we want to take a personal approach, because I myself, I'm not interested in, you know, chronologically doing an account of how this person, you know, achieved this and achieved that. And I think it's
not a biography or something. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not an assignment. It's a creation. So although it's a creation, but I should say, you know, the opera itself is based on historical facts and truth. So and Sun Yat-sen did live a life as, you know, he married the first wife and he divorced her, and to be able to marry Song Qingling, who is his true love, although they are, you know, they are more than 20 years apart from each other. And because of that, Qingling's father, who was Sun Yat-sen's very best friend and supporter, broke off the friendship, and because he doesn't want his daughter to marry Sun Yat-sen.
Where did you get the words? Is there a diary? Where did the librettist find the words to use?
Well, the libretto, like for example, what people's Sun Yat-sen singing a lot of time is from his own speech. So those are his exact words. Now, as story wise, and the librettist, she created the words as a libretto, you know, but the historical event is accurate. So that is the, you know, that's the fact, and then the liberty, of course, who said what to whom, and if we don't find the exact words, then she created the words. But while you're touching on the words, I should say one of the bigger challenge for us and for her is how should the language to be produced? For example, this opera, this time period taking from late 19th century to early 20th century, and people speak very differently then from now. Should the character speak a modern day Chinese or ancient time Chinese or the language as they will speak at that time? So we decided to respect the tradition, to create the dialogue and the language people will speak around that period of time. That's what we call half ancient, half modern Chinese.
How difficult would it be for your average speaker of maybe both Mandarin and Cantonese to understand the work without subtitles?
Well, I think it does need, I think the language itself is so, to me, it's very beautiful because it's like a poetry. And maybe like Shakespeare, you know.
That's what I was just about to jump to. Yeah.
Yeah, just think about it. Some people could understand everything, some people can't. Just depends on which level of, you know, of knowledge you have. So the subtitle, what we did in Hong Kong is we have two kinds of subtitle. One is English translation, and one is the Chinese libretto, right? So the audience actually could see both. Now, the translation, because it's not a word-to-word translation, so it could not capture exactly how beautiful this language is. But again, for the audience who don't understand Chinese, they could gather the, you know, the meaning and what they are talking about.
So when you were So when you're first writing for this, we saw at Vox, was it all Chinese singers?
No. Oh.
Let me think. Well, the chorus are not.
But I remember the singers, there were many Chinese, right? I think they were all Chinese.
That's right.
Were you writing these roles for those specific singers or when you were...
Only one person I wrote...
Warren Mark.
And he is the commissioner and he wanted to commission this opera and he is the singer who can, you know, who wants to sing the role of Sun Yat-sen. So I know he will be singing it, so I wrote more tailored to his voice, which is Spinto. And all other characters, I just choose the voice type according to their, you know, what role they are, and also what like how they speak in the opera. Again, opera is international. We have American singers singing Italian opera.
Sure.
We have Chinese opera singing in German or Italian or English. So when Santa Fe came to me talk about, you know, how should we cast, all I told them is, I would love to cast the best singer we can find suitable for the role. So at the end, we do have a mixed cast. A few singers are Chinese singers who, of course, sing in Western operatic style. And several of them are Western, you know, American singers who sing in Chinese. So the end goal is doesn't matter, you know. Vox, they did find Chinese singers to sing it. But again, that would not and was not my, absolute request.
Uh-huh. So now how do you get the non-Chinese singers to sing and sound like they're actually singing Chinese? Is it written out in regular? How good are the Americans at Chinese?
it's like any language. I was watching House of the Dead a few years ago, and I can tell you there are more audience in the Met, maybe speak Chinese than speak Czech. But again,
great point. That's a great point. Yeah, we think of Chinese being so distant, but it's not in the opera.
If singer could sing Czech, which I'm sure most of those singers were not born to speak Czech, and we just need a commitment. And I think with a good diction coaching, and what happened with Chinese is although originally our characters, however, we use this system called Pinyin. And so you could spell it out with letters. So, for example, my last name is Huang, you know, H-U-A-N-G. But in the real Chinese, it's not H-U-A-N-G, it's a Chinese character.
Right.
But we are able to use letter to help people to spell it out and people could pronounce it. So that is how this opera is written. So I put in those pinyins for all the characters. And the singers, they will learn how to pronounce it. And actually, it sounds quite good, I should say.
I have another question.
Sorry,
we were just about to ask the exact same question.
Like, are there sort of microtones within the musical notation? Because Chinese has a tonal aspect that English doesn't really have. Do those tones exist within the libretto and the music? So does that make it harder for Americans to sing?
Well, I think it's harder for everyone to sing in that aspect because Chinese is based on these four tones, you know, ma, 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 right? So, unlike English, you could say, I love you, I love you, I love you. You all understand this, I love you.
Yes,
but in Chinese, if you put the sound a little bit different, it will lose the meaning.
Right.
So the challenge, and also I believe, same as writing for English, which I also write for opera in English as well, is you do want to honor the accent and the rhythm of the word. So in Chinese, I love you is 我爱你. So you do want to emphasize on the word I and put the I higher than 我, which is I. I means love, me is you.
But this is where it gets interesting. Do you have to put the note higher? Do you have to just have something that emphasizes it? Could it be just a rhythm? You know what I mean? How much of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My technique is I would put the note also higher. Uh-huh. Not just the rhythm is longer or on the stronger beat, you know.
Right.
But so that way people will be able to understand easier.
Yeah, that makes it easier for the singers. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's great.
Are there times when you compose against that, like when a character's lying, or is there a time that you want to sort of throw it off kilter?
There are times, according to the drama, you know, there are times I repeat certain words to emphasize on the meaning of it. The short answer is there are times I do break these rules because music is not a machine, you know. If it's that simple, then everyone could write it. So everything
expressive is, choices, yeah.
So now,
yeah.
Do your music have ornamentation?
By the way, so just to go back to your previous question, when are those times? So one example I could tell you is there was one scene, you know, those sung by three young girls who is very excited to see Sonia Sen, who will arrive later to this party. So the way I create their voice is I have them, three of them, share one vocal line, you know what I'm saying? So,
mm-hmm.
so
they sing in unison.
Not in unison. So basically, they trade words.
I see. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you listen to one singer just sing by herself, it doesn't make sense.
It's like interlocking.
Oh yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, okay. So you have to put all three of them together. Realistically, of course, people would not sing or speak that way.
Right.
But I think dramatically, it creates this beautiful impressionistic kind of like, you know, they are, so
they're locked in step.
They're excited about it. And it also is this impression of like, you know, they are young girls, you know, they are about to see their hero, right? So they are shy about it, so this and that, so mean to be not to make it as linear as it is, but three voices combined together creates this artistic feeling, and to me that trumps the realistic drama.
So now what about ornamentation, and perhaps can you talk, is there any improvisation within that?
Yes. Now, ornaments, that's something I sometimes talk to people about. In Chinese, because the Chinese character is very harsh, right? Like, I won't say harsh, but it's very da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So one character, percussive. So it's a very dramatic language. So like, 我爱你, I love you, 我爱你. So you have to speak it like, you know, very clear. So in that sense, when you set to music, often if you just sing set one note per character, it will sound very very rough, you know, very very
wooden or something. Yeah.
Exactly. To me, that was not the approach I would like to take. For those of you who's seen the Pinia Pavilion, I mean, it's several nights, right? But the story is just a simple story, and each line they sing it very, very, very long because they really put in a lot of notes to transfer from one character to another character. So so I studied Chinese opera. At first I think why they have to do that, you know, but then I now understand. So that it will sound smooth, it will, you know, it will make the line become more connected, more smooth, and more legato. So by doing so, I also use similar approach like that. So I call those bridges from one note to another note. There are other notes as bridge. So, but in this case, they are not as just ornaments. They are not like you could add it or you could take it out or you could add more, you could add less. But they are the necessary steps. So you will hear them.
It's funny because that word in English, it has this colloquial meaning, ornament, that's something that's just kind of added, like a frill almost. But yeah. If you think about the role of ornaments in somebody like Bach's music, you know, I wouldn't want to hear any Bach without any ornaments, because it's integral to that kind of music, you know. So yeah. I think what you're saying is that it's expressive, and it's melismatic, but it's not extra. It's not added on. It's an yeah. important part of the line.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, I always ask myself this question: is this necessary? Mm-hmm. It should only help the vocal line, help the line to achieve what it should be, and mm-hmm. should not be extra, and should not be less. So, and I don't like, you know, to be very decorative either, and mm-hmm. I don't want it to be sound like a robot singing either. So mm-hmm. there is a fine line there, and that's what I'm trying to achieve.
Is there any mm-hmm. improvisation in it? Is there? Do the singers have the liberty to trill or do anything, or is it really note for note composed out?
Most of time, note to note composed out, and there is. I use this dotted line as one of my technique, like notation. Mm-hmm. So you have a dotted line. So basically, that means the singer will put pause into that sound, like So again, how many, how fast, how slow, that's up to the singer, but I just want that kind of, you know, that kind of singing in that.
Awesome.
So.
Wait, I have one more question just because I'll forget it. So Huang, I don't think it's that common in West that Western composers sing, and I see that, you know, every time I see your name, I see folk singer attached to it, and I've heard you sing, and mm-hmm. and I just wonder how common is it that is it uncommon in China to study music compositionally and also be a singer?
So to understand you clearly, you say, is it common to have someone who write music also sing, or uncommon, right?
Because uh-huh. My impression is that it's not that common. I mean, all composers maybe study singing mm-hmm. a little bit, but most of them are kind of afraid of it. Certainly, most of them are not brave enough to sing in public.
Right.
I think
it's true, same as a Chinese composer as well. Not everyone sings, and some people do and some don't. Most of them don't. To me, I always tell people I have a very loud voice. You know, when I laugh, I laugh very loudly. This is the Southern culture. You know, for example, in the village, if someone walk by, you know, you open the door, you invite them come to have lunch with you, have dinner with you. So it's a very warm culture, and we talk loudly. You know, for example, when you see a good friend, you're supposed to talk the loudest. When you see someone who you don't know, you speak very soft. So the way it's very opposite of the Western culture.
And I like this. I want
to show.
Yeah. So the louder you are, the warmer you are. So somehow I got this loud voice, and I also not shy to sing, and I do sing, and I do sing in tune. And I'm not trained as an opera singer, so that's something I do not claim. But I sing different things. I sing folk rock. I sing folk music. I sing pop music. So no matter what you call my voice type is, it is an organic voice, I would like to say.
Yeah,
that's great. And do you put those character things that you mentioned of part of the Southern culture, do you put aspects of that into your opera writing? Like, can you tell where certain characters are from within your opera by the way that they sing or the way that they speak?
Well, I think to me, character building and writing is important in opera, no matter it's in Western or Eastern opera or in new opera. So it's less about geographically where they are from, but I think it's more about their background, right? So, for example, with first wife, Sun Yat-sen's first wife, and she is from the South, and she is a traditional Bangfit lady. So her musical character has more traditionalism in it. No matter you say it's more pentatonic or whatever you call that, but definitely there are more that it tip more towards Chinese elements. And she also sang in Cantonese when she confronted Sun Yat-sen and sing to Sun Yat-sen directly face to face. Because I do feel that is the language they speak to each other in real life, because both of them are from Canton. So for them to sing in Cantonese is perfect. Now, for the audience, when they hear that, yes, they could tell they are from Canton, from the south. But with Sun Yat-sen's second wife, who actually was trained in America and a very Western-style lady, and again, she's the mother of the nation, so her music has a different character to it, and her voice type also is different as well. So all this put into consideration, and when you come to see this opera, you could tell quite clearly, even without knowing their name or knowing what they are singing, you could tell who might fit with which role, you know.
That's fantastic.
I hate to bring this discussion to an end, but I have to. We're running out of time.
Understand.
It'll be our first four-hour podcast.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. And I just want to remind people that this is happening at the end of July, July 26th through August 14th. Also in Santa Fe this summer, they're doing Don Pasquale, Carmen, Fidelio. So they're doing some great, you know, traditional opera as well. And they're doing the Impresario and Le Rossignol. Oh, did I say that wrong? Rossignol.
You did it.
All right. Yeah.
Woo. But the Dr. Sun Yat-sen is the big finale of the whole summer. So if you can make it out there, please do. I know that Walker,
yes,
you're going to be out there.
I'll probably be out there in August. Are you going to be out there then?
Yes.
Yes, I will be. Yeah.
Fantastic. I'll look you up.
We will finally see each other.
All right.
Well, thanks.
Never too late. Never too late. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Wang Ro. It's so great to have you on.
Thank you, everyone. And it's great to be on your show and great to talk as well. So.
Great. And I've been wanting to have you on ever since, you know, 4 years ago. We finally have an excuse.
Well, opera's long and life is short. So.
That's good. That's a good point. Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
All right.
If you're coming to New York this June, why not check out Rameau's Pygmalion June 17th, 20th, and 21st at Madame Tussauds New York, being performed by On-Site Opera. For more information, check out osopera.org. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Got Stitcher? We're on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio. The smarter way to listen to radio.